No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So please call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008, or we have a chat box and you can send your questions there. And tonight we're very excited to have a very special guest. First, let me welcome my co-host, Maria. Maria, how are you?
We are sizzling here in Southern California. We're in the 90s, and with everything closed, it's really making it challenging for everybody.
Yeah, that's what I understand.
Yeah.
Well, tonight, we're cold and rainy here in Washington.
Oh, are you? My gosh, okay.
Yeah, but tonight we have a special guest with us, Carl Racine, who's the Attorney General of the District of Columbia. Mr. Racine is a former Associate White House Counsel during the Clinton administration. He's President-elect of the Bipartisan National Association of Attorney Generals, and he's the former chair of the Democratic Attorney General's Association, but most importantly, he is the first elected attorney general in the District of Columbia. I'm proud to say that my office was instrumental in pushing for an elected attorney general because we thought if you're going to be a state, you need to act like a state. So we were very happy that he got elected, and he's done a great job. Welcome to the show, Mr. Racine. Thanks so much.
Senator Brown and Maria, it's really a pleasure to be on your show. I'm a constant listener, so having the opportunity to be on is a great joy. I hope that your families are safe and sound as we go through this really debilitating pandemic. And I pray for those folks, particularly D.C. residents, who've lost family and friends, who are anxious or hurting economically as a result of the pandemic. Together, we can get through this. Please practice social distancing and stay at home.
Well, thanks for that, Mr. Attorney General. Let me ask you, let's first deal with the 800-pound gorilla in the room, coronavirus. I know that the New York Attorney General has teamed up with the health department in New York, and they're investigating to make sure nursing homes and retirement communities are following the procedures that have been set forth by the state of New York, because those people are, of course, at much higher risk. What are we doing in Washington, D.C.? What are the challenges for the Attorney General's office in D.C.?
Wow, that's a huge question, Senator. And let me just say that there are a wide variety of issues and concerns and issues around which the Office of Attorney General is working. Of course, the council and the mayor are also working really hard to try to advance the interest in protecting D.C. residents. You mentioned my great friend, New York Attorney General Tish James, and she has been on it from moment one, and she is indeed investigating and encouraging nursing homes and senior communities to do the right thing by these vulnerable residents. The rules are a little different here in D.C., so I can't talk too much other than I can tell you that the Office of Attorney General has made appropriate inquiry, and we're in the process of receiving information and documents from the D.C.-based senior homes all around going after the same thing that Attorney General James in New York is, which is to understand exactly what those homes are doing to protect the D.C. residents. And to the extent that they're not doing enough, we're going to encourage them by various means to stop that it takes to protect this most vulnerable community. My heart goes out to senior residents who are living, you know, in very tough situations, oftentimes not even being able to have physical contact with anyone outside the facility. Rest assured that we're on top of that. In addition to this issue, the Office of Attorney General is trying to make sure that merchants out here who are selling important and necessary items are not gouging consumers. Unfortunately, we've found dozens and dozens and dozens of instances where that's occurred. We've issued cease and desist letters. We're bringing lawsuits. And then we're also having an impact not only locally, but also nationally with other state attorneys general on a bipartisan basis, I should add, where we're encouraging the platforms, Facebook, Amazon, Google, you know, these are the big players where a lot of commerce is done, to do their part in policing gouging and to send the bad actors to us so that we can enforce it. You know, why don't I stay there and let you also know that sadly in the District of Columbia, as we know in other jurisdictions as well, we're going to find that, unfortunately, there will be a number of deaths. And people are going to have to deal with funeral homes in a way that they probably never have anticipated. Oftentimes, vulnerable people dealing with funeral homes are, you know, quite susceptible to being and paying far too much for basic services. So we went ahead and passed through the emergency legislation, Consumer Bill of Rights. Go to our website, www.oag.dc.gov. You'll see exactly what we've got there for consumers who are experiencing funeral homes and the like for the first time. We want to make sure that you're protected. And if you have any questions, again, reach out to us at www.oag.dc.gov.
Great. Well, you know, we have a couple of callers already. You want to take one of these calls? Do you have a question?
Absolutely.
You have a question for Attorney General Racine? Hello?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, hi. Who's
you ready
this?
For my question? Are you ready for
Absolutely,
my question?
Sir.
Yes, sir. We're ready for your question.
All right. All right. My question for D.C. Attorney General Racine is, A, sir, with the D.C. Council being disproportionate, as it currently is, by whites, and with at least 15 individuals who are non-majority party candidates that have not been declared as an independent candidate by the Board of Elections requirement of 4,000 signature petition of residents of D.C. to qualify for the independent at-large seat on the City Council. With okay. non-white minorities on the ballot to run for the independent and large seat, why are you endorsing a white non-minority for the large independent council seat even before petitions to declare 4,000 signatures are submitted to candidates by candidates to be declared by the Board of Elections as being qualified to run for office? Okay. Are you trying in some way?
All right, let him answer the question.
I'm almost there. Are you trying in some way to tip the scales of democracy? And in closing, sir, do you support statehood for D.C.?
Do I support the last part? I didn't hear. I'm sorry.
Do you support D.C. for statehood?
For D.C.? Yes.
Yeah, that's an easy answer. Of course I support statehood for D.C. You know, the senator has been a long warrior in the struggle for statehood, and I do believe that we deserve statehood. I would add that we also deserve the other $750 million that the president and the Congress denied the District of Columbia by designating us a territory. The other thing I'd say about statehood is this. It's really important for us to, you know, not only continuously develop support in our own party, the Democrats. It's really important for us to get support from some reasonable Republicans. And we've done
that. Yeah, I don't
want
to go off on a statement. Not to interrupt you. I just wanted your position on statehood, and I'm pleased that you're in support of it. But my primary concern was the rationale that you are supporting Lazarus.
Ed Lazarus, sure.
For the Ed Lazarus.
So let me explain. Yeah, that.
I know
let me explain that to you. Let me explain that to you quite simply. So I've supported a lot of candidates, as you might know, during my 5 years as Attorney General. And I go through the same analysis for each candidate, regardless of their race, regardless of their gender, regardless of their ethnicity. And what I go through is I try to figure out whether or not the candidate has demonstrated in their life experience exceptionalism in their discipline. Number one, whether they care by demonstrated actions about vulnerable communities, and whether they have the heart of a public servant. And that's why I supported Trayon White. That's why I supported Robert White. That's why I'm supporting Janice Lewis in Ward 4. That's why I'm supporting Brooke Pinto in Ward 2. And that's indeed why I'm supporting Ed Lazier as the at-large member, because Ed Lazier, in my view, and I could be wrong, other people could have a different opinion, but Ed Lazier, in my view, understands the budget of the District of Columbia better than any person who is not on the council. And boy, oh boy, do we need expertise on the budget. And that's why I'm endorsing Ed Lazier. It's not for me about a racial question. It's about a question as to where your heart is and where your actions are around vulnerable people. And yes, that means brown and black people. And I stand by that, and I stand by my commitment to that community. Brooke Pinto in Ward 2, Janice Lewis in Ward 4, Robert White, at-large member, Trayon White in Ward 8, and yes, Ed Lazier is at-large.
Yeah, and that's the way it should be, Mr. Attorney General. I mean, sometimes we don't think of racism as a two-way street, but it certainly is. And if you're going to support people on the basis of their qualifications, then race shouldn't matter. And I commend you for that.
Now, look, I would say that the caller, I agree with you, and I think the caller raised a fair point about why so early. And look, they're friends of mine who are running for the at-large seat. For example, I think Marcus Batchelor is quite talented. I also think Franklin Garcia is a terrific person, and he's done well for the District of Columbia. I also am a fan of Monica Palacio, big fan of hers and what she did at the Office of Human Rights. I just happen to know, having worked with Mr. Lazier, having seen him run in the last election, having understood his expertise, I happen to be of the view, and people can discount it, that he's going to be an excellent council member.
Well, you got no argument here, Mr. Attorney General. I'm not sure that you know this, but the organization that he was executive director of, the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute, was started by an organization that I ran for many years, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. So we love Ed, too.
And he was a guest on our show recently.
Yeah.
Can I ask, though, as somebody who's not in the Beltway like you two are, may I ask how it is that the District of Columbia had an election for Attorney General in 2015 and that you won it? And could you give us some perspective and some history about that for those of us outside the Beltway?
Yes, please, I'll tell you that. And I have to say that no doubt about it, Senator Brown was a strong advocate for us doing everything, including having elected offices that states had. That's why he's a senator. And so for the history of the District of Columbia since 1972, when it got limited statehood from Congress, we did not have an elected attorney general. There was something called the Corporation Council, and then there was an attorney general, but not an elected attorney general. That attorney general in the predecessor office reported directly to the mayor. I think people got tired of that, and people wanted to have an elected attorney general who would not only advise the government, but also bring in some initiatives that worked for regular people. And so a grassroots group, a lot of people, including Senator Brown's team really pressed hard, and sure enough, over 73% through a referendum of D.C. voters said they wanted to elect an attorney general and have that person be independent of the mayor's office and be independent and be able to be elected and fired by the people based on their values as demonstrated by their actions. And I'm very fortunate. I won in a very crowded, tough race with really good candidates. And I ran essentially unopposed the second time. Hopefully that means the people are favorable, although I learned more from constructive criticism than I...
Well, let me say, Carl, I hope you can still hear us. For our listeners, Mr. Racine is on his car phone, so he's doing the best he can. He's on his way back from Philadelphia, and we certainly appreciate his accommodation. And let me also add, you know, as the first person in this office, Mr. Racine, you've done a lot to expand the reach of the Attorney General's office, and we really appreciate that. I think that's really important. You know, you're kind of our George Washington in this office, you know, right? Washington set the tone for the presidency, and it lasted for 150 years until Franklin Roosevelt and a couple of other people decided they were going to change things. So you're doing a good job at that. And most recently, you've put together a task force. You've hired an important attorney to work on corruption in the District of Columbia. Can we talk about that for a minute, what you hope to accomplish there? Because seven people have gone to jail or left office. So let's talk about that.
You know, sadly, one of the biggest problems, in our democracy and democracies throughout the world, and even places that don't have democracies, are appointed officials, elected people, those who would be close to them to profit from them, who are essentially, engaged in potential wrongdoing, or public corruption. In the District of Columbia, we've not really had a local public corruption prosecutor. Instead, that function has been essentially delegated to the unelected federal U.S. attorney here in D.C., and they've done some things at times and not done some things at other times. Well, after 5 years in office, my goal was to create enough credibility that we would be able to launch a public corruption section in our office where we could take care of our own trash, if you will, instead of waiting for a federal prosecutor to wade in, sometimes rightfully, sometimes overzealously, against our own people in the District of Columbia. And so all I'm seeking to do is to do that which Maria, my great friend Javier Becerra, has in California, the Attorney General, which is a public integrity and public corruption office. Tish James in New York, public integrity, public corruption office. Kwame Raoul in Illinois, public integrity and public corruption office. If it's good enough for other states, why isn't it good enough for D.C.? If they don't like what the Attorney General is doing, they can obviously vote him for now out of office. So that's why we're launching this, to bring integrity into government.
Well, that's great. And I see we have another caller, Deborah Brown. Deborah, are you there? Do you have a question for the Attorney General?
I'm here.
Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I'm Deborah Brown, and I live in the Deanwood area. And first of all, I want to give honor to God, to which all our blessings flow. And Senator Brown, I worked for you when you were trying to get reelected last term. So congratulations
on
that.
Brown.
You're very welcome. But Carl Racine, we have a problem over here at Deanwood in which there is, I know you've heard about it, the illegal fire department that they're building in this area. They have broken so many D.C. laws that it is so laughable, and we can't get any help over here, and we need your assistance. If you're fighting corruption that's going on in the D.C. government, this is a prime example of corruption at its highest level. We need for you to look in it. But another thing that I want to find out from you, We had an appeal with the BZA in December 8th of 2019. They told us it would take more than a year to get a copy of the transcript. We need to know why would it take more than a year to get a written copy of that transcript from that case back in December.
I'm going to thank you very much, Ms. Brown. Ms. Brown, I hope you're listening because I'm going to give you my email address. It's karl.racine@dc.gov. If it's possible, I really would appreciate your sending both of those items to me. I'm happy to take a look at the first in the Dean Wood area around the fire station, and then the second issue around the transcript for the DCCA. Let me do a little research on that. I promise to get back with you.
Okay, Maria, I know you have a wonderful question.
I want to ask on a personal note, if you don't mind, Attorney General,
sure.
Tell me about your basketball career.
So, look, I just loved playing basketball as a kid in the District of Columbia. And for me, basketball was a liberating experience in the sense that it got me around every area of the District of Columbia. I got to tell you, it really enhanced my social justice awareness because I realized that there were kids who were raised up in areas in D.C. that were not as comfortable as where I was raised, who were every bit as talented as I was, not only on the basketball court, but also in just flat-out pure intelligence. And I remember coming back home and telling my mom that, you know, this is not fair because in certain areas of town, you know, the water fountain didn't work. They didn't have nets. And what's more, the kids were telling me that their schools were not as safe as the school I went to. And that was imbued in me early on. Luckily, I did okay in basketball. I went on to, you know, play high school at a great high school, St. John's. You know, played in an all-star game where Michael Jordan and Patrick Ewing played. Believe me, they were a lot better than I was. So I went to Penn, University of Pennsylvania, played hoops there. And that was where my career ended after 4 years of college. You know, and just started, went to law school, and I still shoot around a little bit, but believe me, if you're a basketball player and you're under 70, you can beat me one-on-one.
Well, look at how modest you are. You were the captain of the team at the University of Pennsylvania.
You know what? I was. That was something that was I was honored because my peers elected me captain when I was a junior.
That's saying a lot. Thank you for sharing that. I'd love to know everything that is the dimension that creates the human being that we speak to, regardless of your position or your accomplishments, because, as you said, basketball turns you on to social justice.
And, there's no doubt about that. You know, that and I had, you know, the incredible bounty Ms. Brown talked about, thank God, you know, I do every day, being raised by incredible parents. You know, my mother was an educator, 45 years at the University District of Columbia. You know, my father was a businessman and a politician, and they cared about other people more than they cared about themselves. And, you know, that if I have a little bit of that, it's because of them.
Well, and they came from Haiti, right?
Oh, yeah. We are full Haitian. I became naturalized as an American citizen after my father passed. That was always his dream, that my sister and I would become American citizens and that we would fully participate in democracy. You know, I feel his presence every day, and I think for the most part, he's proud.
Nice.
I'm sure he is. And now I know that we have something in common because basketball really, you know, affected my life as well, since I was the absolute worst player on my Pop Warner basketball team. It led me in the direction of developing a wonderful personality so that I could relate to people, because I certainly couldn't do it on the court. I warmed more benches than, you know, Carter has liver pills, as you used to say. But
I always tell young kids who like to play.
Maria's actually an athlete.
Yeah, I played in college too, but I didn't travel with the team. So I was who they went up against when we were at home. So I was good enough to do that, but not good enough to travel.
I love, you know, there's nothing like being involved in a group that has one objective, and that objective, you know, has to be winning or feeding the homeless, then it's all for one. And, you know, that, you know, they always say that trite statement, there's no I in team. Mm-hmm. You know, there is a me in team, but it ain't about me. It's about mm-hmm. the group and the objective, and, you know, learn that from playing.
Yeah, I think that's a very important lesson that, you know, even the bad kids like me that didn't get much playing time learn. Speaking of a team effort that we need to put forth, and staying on the issue of corruption for a minute, as you know, Mr. Attorney General, you were sitting right there with me in the hearing room when they were voting on the statehood bill that's now before the House of Representatives, and many, many times our a friend from North Carolina, Republican congressman, brought up Harry Thomas, Michael Brown, Kwame Brown, Jack Evans, Jim Graham, all these people that have had problems in the District of Columbia. So this really, really, the corruption thing really hurts our statehood effort because it gives them an excuse. And they're always looking for an excuse. As you mentioned already, we were cheated out of, the way we feel anyway, we were cheated out of $750 million in these bills that have been recently passed by Congress to help us during this terrible crisis. So what are your feelings about that, how it relates to statehood?
You're so right. You're so right, Senator. You know, the folks who do not want us to have statehood are going to pick on any reason to really shove it down our throats. And the idea that for some reason D.C. is more corrupt than any other state and therefore we shouldn't have become a state is ridiculous, because I guarantee you we can go to North Carolina and dig up some bodies and find, a litany of public corruption. Unfortunately, public corruption is endemic to politics, partly because of there being so much money in the game. So I think it is a tool that's used against us. It's why it's important for us to police ourselves. It's why it's important for us to have no doubt and don't be afraid to go against people who have shown that they lack integrity. And that's why I'm supporting Brooke Pinto in Ward 2. Jack Evans, a council member, long time, someone who I respect as an individual, I think he let us down. And I think that the district residents can do better. And better is right there for them in Ward 2 and Brooke Pinto. I do want to say again, though, you know, I think where we have, we still have an opportunity in the statehood battle is to get other people, including Republicans, to support us. And that takes a lot of work. That's why I was really proud that 10 Republican state attorney general, 10 people from Ohio, Florida, and other states, Idaho, they came out and supported D.C.'s effort to be considered a state for purposes of the relief fund. That's unprecedented.
We have
37 AGs and 10 Republicans. So, you know, if I could do anything to advance the cause of statehood, it would be to get us to broaden the room a little bit and take our case to reasonable Republicans. You know what? They may not join us right away, but after a while, when they see how you work, that you're a person of integrity, you've supported them when you didn't have to, they're going to come and be with us in our time of need.
Well, I agree with
advantage
that.
Of well, in the future.
And present company is a part of that,
yes.
Because I am a registered
Absolutely.
Republican, and I've been for
Isn't
D.C. for
something?
Statehood. Yeah, and it's like, it's only fair. Forget the two seats of the Senate that are probably most likely going to be Democrats. That's secondary. This isn't political. This is about equity and fairness and equality. And then you can have those discussions later, but not now, not when it's about D.C. for statehood. Hello, don't get it.
Maria, I think you're hitting a home run there, because the fact is, you know, we once had a Democratic White House, Democratic House, and Democratic Senate, statehood was not even on the agenda during that right. time period, the 2-year time period. So, yep. you know, thinking that we are going to solve it all in our own, you know, sort of self-selected same room, I think is short-sighted.
Yes, it truly is. And we have been up, I've had meetings with 5 Republican senators, for example, in the Senate. We haven't gotten any of them to sign on yet, but we're still, you know, knocking on the door. And let me say that Maria is not only a Republican who supports D.C. statehood. She won the D.C. statehood champion, one of the D.C. statehood champion awards in 2019. So she's a very, very, very strong supporter.
Oh, that's sweet of you, Michael.
We very much appreciate that. Thank you, Maria.
It's my honor.
And we appreciate what you're doing. You know, we really have to do it hit this on all 8 cylinders. And that's my next question for you, Mr. Attorney General. Last year, we put $14 million, the city council put $14 million into grants for Arts and Humanities, and they put $200,000 into grants for D.C. statehood. You know, even though I have a vested interest in this, I really believe we need to spend more than $200,000 a year if we expect this to happen. I look to the civil rights movement in the South, and we see that they spent millions and millions and millions of dollars in addition to the righteousness of their cause. They had the backing. They ultimately had national backing that changed everything. What do you think we should do in that regard? Should we be spending more money?
Well, I think you're right. I think that, look, you know, if you've got a priority, it's got to show itself in the budget. You know, at the same time, it's not all about money. It can be about creativity. But, you know, I think there's, you know, there certainly has got to be more money than that couple hundred thousand. For the cause of statehood, particularly if we want to go out and educate people, and you do this so well, you know, young people and people who are real good folks, whether Democrat, Republican, Independent, who just simply don't know that the District of Columbia is totally disenfranchised. And that education isn't going to happen, you know, just by osmosis. We've got to go out in a strategic way and accomplish that does cost a bit of money.
Yeah. Well, we have another caller. We have Dorothy, who's called a couple times to ask some question. Do you have a question for the Attorney General, Dorothy?
Yes, hello. Hey, Mr. Brown, it's Commissioner Douglas. Dorothy Douglas, how you doing?
Commissioner Douglas, thanks for calling in.
How you doing, Commissioner?
Yeah. Hey, everybody. How you doing, Brown?
How you doing, Mr.
Congressman? Great, great.
I'm great. Thank you, Dorothy.
So what's your question, Dorothy?
My question is I want to ask you something in reference to, I think Ms. Brown had already asked the question out in reference to the BZA board. But like I said, there's a lot of corruption, and my concern is I'm right here. I'm like 20 feet away from where this project is being done, being built. How can the city council get away our tax dollars without involving our decision to say that we want this money to go to these developers? And that's a lot of money. You're talking about $35 million. I don't have that kind of money, but yet they have that opportunity to let them have this kind of money without our input. So that really needs to be really looked at down the road. How do we continue to let other big developers come in and take, receive that our tax dollars without our decision-making, you know, at the city council? And my other question is real quick, is reference to education. The children did not, my grandkids, after I'm buying a computer for her, which she's in 11th grade now. What happened to the computers for the youth? They have to work. How will they be able to get their grades in when D.C. has not had that opportunity to provide those children for computers? Maryland, Virginia has already gave them education tools to work with. That should have been the first thing on the line for those kids to have an opportunity to work with to get their work assignments done. So that's my concern. And I'll get back to the other thing with the case, which is Devin and I are speaking on. I can talk with you, Mr. Carver, soon. That's my concern.
Okay.
Okay, thanks, Darcy.
All right, let me take that on.
I'm not sure the second question is really an attorney general question, but do the best you can there, Mr. Attorney General.
I tell you what, we try to help all the time, number one. Number two, in the attorney general space, it's not well understood, but on a national level and local level, we interface frequently with AT&T, Verizon, Comcast. And why do I mention those three? T-Mobile, Sprint now. I mentioned those four because they're in charge of providing Wi-Fi broadband Wi-Fi in all of our communities. And we know, just like there are food deserts, Maria, in Washington, in the most underserved and poorest areas in the city, there are also Wi-Fi broadband deserts in those areas, where even if the kid had the right device, and we know that in those areas of town, kids don't have the iPod or the iPad or the Surface, or the appropriate device. And we know that disproportionately, of course, they don't have the broadband Wi-Fi. So that's a great question, a fair question. And I think it's on us, not only as attorney generals, but the council, the mayor, to really draw a clear picture, like a map of the District of Columbia, and tell the citizens, residents, where the Wi-Fi, broadband Wi-Fi is and where it isn't, why not, and what's being done to get it there. That's the second question. On the first question, look, I think the developers have had a romp of the District of Columbia, over the last dozen plus years. And that's not to say that all developers are bad. That's far from the case. Most of them are just going about their business in an honest way. However, it's clear, massive problem in the District of Columbia, while having certain benefits, has also caused a hell of a lot of displacement of people who used to live here without regard to them. There are pockets in Capitol Hill, for example, where 75% of black folks used to live there no longer live there.
That's
you
right.
Call it something benign and clumsy like gentrification, but let's call it what it is. It's flat-out intense displacement, the most intense displacement in the country. And I just think it's high time to have more balance in growth and development than that. It hurts our people, the very people who were here during the roughest times in the District of Columbia. And I mean the 60s. I mean the riots. I mean the law and order 70s. The rough and tumble times of high crime in the 80s and 90s. These people want to stay in our city. We should do everything we can to keep them here.
I want to say too. I don't have nowhere else to go, Mr. Carl was saying, and that's my concern. And I know I have other questions, but I can talk to you offline in regards to that. So I really appreciate you and Mr. Brown expressing.
I appreciate it, Commissioner. We got to be tough. No, I know. It's not about making every developer an evil person. It's not that at all. Like I said, most are decent, most follow the law. But let's be honest about what's happened. Entire peoples have been entirely displaced.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for calling in, Dorothy. You know that I love you. You've been a commissioner a long time in your neighborhood, and we certainly appreciate your service to the District of Columbia. And, that brings up an important point, Mr. Attorney General. What do we consider corruption? I'm glad that you're talking the way you are about developers and other people because, when you take a bribe, that's pretty simple and straightforward, right? Or when you steal
Correct.
Money from the government, that's pretty straightforward. But there's a lot of subtle corruption in the District of Columbia. We had a chairman of the council that ordered two SUVs on the first day of work. Those kind of things. People that's true. And we now have, by the way, I also, along with you and Senator Blumenthal have endorsed Brooke Pinto. We have a situation with Jack Evans, a guy that I like too, but he did wrong. He did the ultimate wrong in public office, in my opinion, and now he's running again. What are we going to do with that? What happened?
That is an amazing story.
Yeah. What do we do if he gets reelected?
Well, I think ultimately voters, have the right to decide.
And at the end of the day, you know, that's why folks like Brooke are waging strong campaigns. And it's up to Ward 2 voters to decide who their best candidate is. You and I have made it clear that we're, you know, we've time to turn the page and yeah. move to hard work, integrity, and a life record, not only of legislative experience, but of public service in a true and selfless way with Brooke Bindo. I think public corruption can be, you know, defined broadly here. It is, as you say, you know, the easy case of the politician on the take, taking cash, not disclosing clients on ethics forms, not telling you why, what he did or she did for those clients, and those clients, by the way, never telling you why they paid the person hundreds of thousands of dollars. That's easy. There's also public corruption, you know, quite honestly, on the fringe of a politician, where people, you know, are playing the contribution game, looking to get something, usually not on merit, but instead on the basis of their close relationships. And when you dig into those things, you oftentimes see violations of the law. I would also note, in my view, public corruption includes the not-for-profit world, where not-for-profit organizations get benefits, tax benefits, pay less than you and I do, for not having to be a for-profit entity. Well, where they're not following their not-for-profit mission, where they're engaged in self-dealing, where they're not transparent in reporting how the money is spent, to me, that's public corruption. So I've hired a fabulous individual named Jonathan Kravis. Jonathan is one of the best prosecutors, federal prosecutors in America. He was most recently the prosecutor in the Roger Stone case, you know, left that matter because he didn't like the interference coming from up high in the Attorney General Barr's office. That's the kind of person that we want to have guide us in the District of Columbia as we establish this public corruption section so that we do the right thing by the District of Columbia. John's going to give us a report, Jonathan will, in about 8 weeks, and I'm sure we'll kick it around. We'll also, of course, talk with the Judiciary Chairman, a terrific council member, Charles Allen, and then we'll see exactly where we end up. But we just think it's time to do what other states have always done, which is take your own trash out. And if there are misdeeds, problems, we can take care of it ourselves and not call on our federal uncle to help us out.
Well, that's great. And as let me say that as somebody who just got my tax exempt clearance on the nonprofit I started from the IRS, I'm going to go make sure right after I get off the radio that all our forms are in and that we've dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's. But no, I think that's very important, Mr. Attorney General. And then again, let me just say that I think you've done a lot to push what the what this office should be, because really nobody knew what it should be when we transformed it from the mayor's lawyer to the people's lawyer. And I think you've done a great job of that. Do you want to talk for a minute, because I find this so interesting, about the emollients case that you brought against the president?
Sure. So thank you, you know, very much for, you know, the compliment. I appreciate that. Like I said, I learned more from constructive criticism than compliments. Like any human being, I appreciate it.
I'm leaving that to Maria.
Case, okay, Maria. So the emoluments case is a very, very basic constitutional case. Our founding fathers were imperfect, but they were very concerned when starting a democracy that federal officers, including the President of the United States, might sell out the people for money. And so they included a clause that said no federal officer shall receive a foreign emolument, which means a gift, anything of value, money, from another foreign country. There's also a domestic emolument clause that forbids federal officials from receiving things of value from states or agencies. Well, Donald Trump told everybody straight up at the outset that he was above conflicts. that he could not have a conflict because he's a president of the United States. Then he proceeded to go ahead and start his hotel, of course, while receiving monies from foreign countries. These foreign countries made it very clear why they were staying at the Trump Hotel. They said, in quotes, "I came here to show the president how much I appreciate him because I would like him to decide something that is really important to me. I came to curry favor," another one said. So that's why they were doing business there. And that Trump Hotel, I can't say I've ever been, and the bars and restaurants, they're like a den of inequity, where everything that was going on there was all about pay-to-play politics. And it's an offensive thing to the Constitution. So we brought suit. We survived the motion to dismiss in the Federal District Court in Maryland. The government launched a Hail Mary appeal before the Fourth Circuit, and they won that appeal before a three-judge panel. It was very conservative. And then we filed for a rehearing en banc before the entire 15-judge panel. And we had one heck of a hearing where our Solicitor General was fabulous, Lauren Alacon, and now we're awaiting that decision. We think we win that case. And if we win that case before the Fourth Circuit, we'll renew our 38 subpoenas that we sent out to Trump-related entities and a whole bunch of other entities that we think were doing business with the president to curry favor. It's as simple as that. We are a nation of laws, not a nation with the king. And obviously the president has a different view. We think we win the emolument.
Okay. Maria, do you have a question?
I do. Would you tell and share more about your Tuesday Twitter chats? Because I know you use that to engage students, but also families as well. And you do that weekly, I believe.
Let me tell you, I'm so proud of my team at the Office of Attorney General. Lawyers are fantastic. The non-lawyer professionals, including my communications team, my community engagement team, are really outstanding, and they make it a priority to absolutely try as much as we can to listen to young people. And so we've got several programs going on where we engage young people. And you're right, last week we talked to young people about domestic violence, about violence and consent and dating, and then anything else that they wanted to talk about. And what we find is when we listen to young people about those issues, including about the issue of intractable violence, we hear pearls of wisdom that sometimes may seem obvious, but we adults aren't following and aren't implementing them. And so that's what the Twitter account is all about, and the engagement that we have with young people. We've got a great program called View the Right Thing Challenge, where young people write in about their experiences with violence and make suggestions about how to stop the violence. Let me give you what the number one suggestion is. The number one suggestion is more trauma-informed counselors in schools. That kids come to school with all manner of issues. And, you know, the job of the teacher is so hard that they can't be trained enough to be counselors and trauma-informed counselors. But kids need outlets to talk to. So listening to kids around those kinds of issues are incredibly important. We have an award ceremony senators attended called the Right Direction Award, where we award kids who may have made a mistake, may have made a serious mistake in the course of the last year, or a kid who may have not made a mistake and just done the right thing. And we award those kids the Right Direction Award because they're going in the right direction. Kids need attention, they need praise, they need recognition, and they need a listening ear. And we try to do that at the Office of Attorney General.
Well, and now more than ever, since our students aren't able to go to schools.
It's incredible. Yeah. And so, you know, I was just with some young folks the other day, and I had the benefit of being with my niece and nephews just earlier today. And, you know, we're talking about COVID-19 and whatnot, and I asked them where they get their information from. And I got to say, I was surprised that, you know, it wasn't the Washington Post, it wasn't the L.A. Times, it wasn't the New York Times. You know, it's TikTok, it's Instagram, it's Snapchat, And it makes you want to make sure, you know, as a state attorney general, that those medium are actually, you know, being responsible about getting the right information out. And I'm happy to say that having, you know, perused some of those websites to see what they're talking about when it comes to COVID-19, I've been actually impressed. You know, not every website, but some websites and platforms are doing the right thing.
Well, you just got another vote from Mrs. Brown, who's a high school librarian, who agrees with you that we should be keeping a close eye on these things. But, Mr. Attorney General, we're starting to run out of time. You want to give people your website again in case they have further questions or they want more information?
Sure. So the website is www.oagdc.gov. My personal, should I say my official email is karl.racine at dc.gov. You know, send the email. Everybody, three people in the office have access to those emails. Make sure that that nothing slips through the cracks. And we'll be responsive to your concerns. We love serving the residents of the District of Columbia. I've got a couple messages to leave you with. Number one, it's important in D.C. to reach out to the Board of Elections and ask for that mail-in ballot. And you need to have it sent to an address where you're going to be at so that you can vote. That's really, really important. It's also important to actually complete your census form. Do it on paper or online. We need to be counted because we know there are forces out there who will not give us every penny that we need. So you can do your part by completing the census. Make sure that you're informed on the vote. And I've already gone through, you know, my people I'm supporting there. So I don't think I need to do that again.
Well, you know, thank you so much, Mr. Attorney General, for taking the time to be with us tonight. Please drive safely and stay safe and keep up the good work. Maria, do you have any last comment?
Other than the fact that I like how you lead with purpose and you lead with intelligence and wisdom, and the fact that you brought this bulk of your career to this position is so beautiful for the residents of the District of Columbia, because they got a one-stop shop when they elected you. So thank you for doing that, because I know public service, and Senator Brown knows it better than everybody, is not easy. And I appreciate your courage and your ability to step up.
And beware, because
well, I really appreciate that, Maria.
And beware, because next time Maria's in town, I plan up on setting up a game of one-on-one. So stay woke.
But just how tall are you, Attorney General?
You know, I'm 6'1", but, you know, we'll play horse.
I'm only 5'9".
We'll get the senator in the game.
I'll carry the water. Okay. Thank you so much.
I'll have fun.
Thank you for everything. Yes, safe drives. Hey, Michael, bye-bye. May I mention that our guest last week, which was Dr. Matthew Feenup, who was talking to us about forecasting and COVID and things, he said that they found baking soda so you can keep your son.
Oh, I can. Thank God. Mrs. Brown would be so happy.
Because if you remember, you offered to trade him with some copious amounts that they were missing.
Regardless of the cost. But and that's good news. We're going to leave you tonight. You know, we always leave you with the song. And this goes out to everybody out there that's staying in and being strong. I know how hard it is for people. We see people emerging now, and you know, so many of us are making these sacrifices. And God bless each and every one of you for doing this. And here's an old classic sung by with the immortal genius of Jury and the Pacemakers. Maria, last word's yours.
Always, we want to thank our listeners for making us a part of your time, because we know how precious it is, and we are honored every week that you've either listen to us live or you download and listen on demand, because we're doing our very best to be reasonable and have an East Coast, West Coast, red, blue kind of consensus about conversations.
When you walk through a storm, hold your head up high and don't be afraid of the dark.
Representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.